On Monday, February 16th, welcome to the program, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Over the past few months, Studio 2 has been hitting the road, traveling to historic taverns across our region as we celebrate the 250th anniversary of America's founding. We recently visited Brittenham's Pub in Lafayette Hill, a space that's been operating as a tavern since 1743.
And as the lore goes, George Washington once spent time here while en route to the Battle of Barren Hill, and one of his companions is the town's namesake, the Marquis de Lafayette.
So today we're asking, who is Lafayette? How did he influence the French-American relationship during the 18th century? And how does his story challenge common narratives around the American Revolution? We kick off things here with our two expert guests at Brittenham's.
First, Chuck Schwamm, Executive Director of the American Friends of Lafayette. Chuck, how you doing?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
Chuck's got a fan club. We love it.
Yeah.
Chuck has helped lead efforts to preserve and commemorate Lafayette's legacy, including major events marking the bicentennial of Lafayette's return to the U.S. in 1824. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, and we are joined by Graham Brent, a longtime member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee. After careers in journalism and nonprofit management, Graham dove deep into revolutionary Philadelphia history and has been working to honor Lafayette's role in the fight for American independence. Graham, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. So I suspect we're going to spend a lot of our time talking about the French military influence on the revolution, but there's also an intellectual influence, right? So Lafayette was born in 1757. When he's about 5 years old, 1762, Rousseau writes and publishes The Social Contract. And that's one of many really important Enlightenment documents. So Graham, I was hoping you could give us a little bit of a foundation on how French Enlightenment thinking influenced the intellectual side of the American Revolution.
Well, it's a great point. There's no question that in many ways, Lafayette was born at exactly the right time, right? So Locke and other folks have been writing about how they saw the world, how it should be rather than how it currently was. And it has been said that whereas the Enlightenment philosophers wrote about what they wanted, Lafayette was one of the first to actually try and put it into action. And when you look at his long life, he lived for 76 years. You know, we're going to be talking probably mostly tonight about what happened here in the United States, but recognize he was still in his very early 30s when the French Revolution started. He was, you know, was extraordinarily young, ambitious, a little bit starry-eyed, which is really almost what you have to be, right?
Yeah.
And in order to get stuff done. And I think that's what attracted, one of the things that attracted him so much to Washington and the folks here.
Yeah. And when we think about the world, change was brewing during Lafayette's young life. And so could you talk about what was going on in France and what was going on in the Americas and in Britain politically that sort of created this perfect storm where this young man decided, I'm going to go across the pond and go to this new land?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we tend to focus on 1776. Obviously, that was a pretty important year for this country. But things have been happening really ever since the end of the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, as it's known in Europe, because it was much more than just an American event. And if you look back at that time, for the next, almost immediately the French and Indian War ended, problems started, at least as seen by the colonists here. Taxes started to come in, extra laws started to be announced by George III. And for the next 10 years, things were rocky, and they got rockier, really leading up to Lexington and Concord, you know, the shot around the world in 75. When he learned about what were known as the insurgents in America, and he learned about them almost by chance at a meeting that was being held by his military commander in the city of Metz in northeastern France. He was in the military, and that's where he was stationed for a while. And his commanding officer, the Duc de Broglie, had invited the Duke of Gloucester to dine with them. It's called the Souper de Metz. And the Duke of Gloucester was George III's younger brother. And curiously, maybe as his brothers are, he had no time for his brother. He thought the insurgents, he actually felt very positive towards the insurgents. Mm. And Lafayette famously said, and I'll probably misquote him, but he said, as soon as he heard the story of the insurgents in America, his heart leapt. Can you complete the phrase?
His heart leapt for America.
Right. And so that was it. And he made his decision, he says in his memoirs later, But that was the point at which he decided that's what he was going to do with his life.
So we have to figure out why his heart leapt, because, you know, he's born in the 1750s, and he's not a poor boy, right, Chuck?
I mean,
he's born into the upper crust of society, and you would think someone in that position would maybe look at insurgents in America and think, why do I want to help the riffraff? Why is Lafayette different?
Rich young Frenchmen like Lafayette were in court, were at Versailles, drinking champagne and eating bonbons and playing cards.
And you're not being rhetorical. He's in Versailles.
He was literally in Versailles.
And he wanted no part of that. He didn't feel like that was worthy of him. He wanted to make a name for himself. He didn't want to just lay around and have a good time every day. So he needed a cause. And this perfect storm of our insurgents and his needing a cause happened exactly as Graham said.
And it probably helps that the other side is the British.
Mm-hmm. It does help that. And don't you find it ironic that Graham has a British accent?
Yeah.
So his father was killed.
By the way, thanks for playing the British National Anthem. I almost fell at home.
So Lafayette, he wanted no part of hanging around. He wanted a cause. And this was something that he felt he could get behind. And he was reading Rousseau. He was reading Voltaire. He was part of that Enlightenment movement. And remember, Lafayette didn't grow up in Paris. Lafayette grew up in the South, mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere. So he was kind of a country bumpkin. He felt out of place in Versailles. Even when he was dancing once with Marie Antoinette, stepped on her toes. Everybody laughed at him. He was the laughingstock of Versailles for a little while. So he wanted no part of that. And when he went to America, people thought he was crazy. And when he came back obviously as a hero.
And by the way, he was raised by his grandmother because his father died when he was a toddler.
And his aunt.
His grandmother and his aunt raised him in the country, like you said. She didn't say you have to only be with other aristocrats. So he had friends across the socioeconomic spectrum.
So that
was unusual.
That's a good point. Two things you said that are important. Number one, he was raised by women. Now, this comes into play for Lafayette in a big way later in life, and even during that time, because he didn't understand the difference between men and women. He didn't get it. He didn't understand why people thought men were smarter or better or anyway. He just didn't understand that. And the other part of it was, and you mentioned this too, is his grandmother and his aunt wanted him to play with the children of the village. They didn't separate them. They invited the children to the castle, to the chateau, so he could be one of them. So when his mother did call him to Paris and he left the South, he was not happy about that.
And I want to just set the scene because he was very young when he went to Paris and he was very young when his mother died. And we think 12, 13, we think baby. That's a kid, that's a baby. But for him, he was making real world decisions at a young teenage age. Graham?
Yeah, you have to remember, of course, that lifespans are much shorter then, so people maybe grew up a little faster. But yeah, he was very young, but he was raised in extraordinary privilege. By the time he arrived in Versailles, he was one of the richest people in France. If not the richest, well, at least in theory. I mean, he hadn't yet reached the age where he could actually inherit all his wealth. But then he gets married into an even wealthier family, and they lived initially in Paris and then at the Noailles mansion. And as Chuck already said, he was then installed in Versailles. Mm.
So lots of maybe high-minded ideals that drew him toward this conflict. But there's also the dynamic of France doesn't like England, and Lafayette has a particular reason not to like the British, which is that his father is killed at war, and perhaps among other reasons. I would love to hear a little more background.
His father was killed when he was 2 years old at the Battle of Minden. At the hands of the British. He was killed by a cannonball, so that couldn't have been pretty, right? That probably was not a good picture. So the situation was, yes, he did have a personal angst against the British, for sure. There was no doubt about that. Of course, France also had, you know, they hated each other. France and Britain just did not get along at all in those days. So
France has just suffered this incredible humiliation in the Americas.
At the hands of the British.
A French and Indian War.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely played a part in it. Sometimes in his memoirs, he kind of plays up this situation where his heart bled for America more than the revenge card, you know what I mean? Definitely the British had played a part in his decision.
Yeah, and he also wanted to make a name for himself. And that was a big thing because he didn't just want to go there and rub elbows. He really wanted to participate and take part. Why do you think that is? What was it inside of him that made him really seek out glory in a lot of ways.
Well, young men at that time were doing that. That was an important thing. A lot of French people came over to help us, but they came over because of the glory. In fact, there was a time when George Washington was really unhappy with the people that were coming over to help because they weren't helping. They were just getting the money and the glory. So when Lafayette came over, they first said no, because they thought they didn't want another person dragging this down. But then they realized that he was a doer. He was somebody that wanted to get his hands dirty. He wanted to command troops. But the most important thing is, in the beginning, and he told Washington this, I want to learn. I want to learn how to do this better. I want to learn from you. And that sparked that relationship between Washington and Lafayette.
Yeah. Rewinding just a little bit before we get to Lafayette, who lands in America in 1777, before we get there, and even before we get to 1776, there's a little something brewing between the colonists and the French, right? I mean, there is, it's not like a spontaneous, oh, wow, France is going to maybe help America, or a French noble is going to come over and try to help the Continental Army. I mean, even when there are just seeds of revolution sprouting, the French are kind of circling around this conflict.
It's a fertilizer.
Yeah, give us this. What's a fertilizer, exactly? Give us a sense, Graham.
Yeah, context is really important here. So if we go back to our sort of mental timeline, we're at 1775, and Ben Franklin has just returned from London. He'd been there for about 10 years. You know, he spent most of his life, really, in either Paris, France, or in England. But he had been there as a representative of the colonies, and he really was an Anglophile for most of the time he was in England.
He loved London.
He did, but things had changed. So by the time he came back, he was absolutely bristling with indignation because he had been publicly humiliated by the British Parliament. And it was at the time when Parliament was just about, many at least, felt that they were at the end of their rope with these colonists. You know, why can't they just come into line? And what they had misjudged was that the colonists had actually been really self-governing themselves for a long time. And they had a lot of ideas about how they wanted to be governed. So he comes back and he is really upset. And so the record shows that he actually concealed a lot of that, but he really felt like the game was up and that independence was really the only way to go. People really weren't talking independence at that time. And so he kept it quiet. But he also knew that if the colonists were going to go independent, they needed help. And where were they going to go? And he initially approached the Netherlands, which really didn't go anywhere at the time, but they ended up recognizing the America shortly after France did. But he thought that maybe France could be an ally. And it was fortuitous because at the same time, little did he know, that was shared by the folks in Paris. And Vergennes, the foreign minister, and Louis XVI were really keen to get back at the British, as we've already said. And when you read the correspondence, it's all about that. It's all about revenge. It's not so much about reclaiming territory at that point. I think what
they don't have the fantasies of taking back Canada, no. But they do think, boy, we'd love to spit
get
in
a jab.
Guys' face.
Yeah.
And they also felt that trade with America would be extremely lucrative. Yeah. And they were heavily in debt. So everyone was in debt after the Seven Years' War, right? Mm-hmm. After the French and Indian War. Everyone was in debt, Britain and France both. And that was why Britain was looking to the colonists to help pay.
Tax, yeah.
Exactly. So that's where we stand when, fortuitously, a gentleman by the name of Julien Alexandre Achard de Bonvouloir shows up in Philadelphia.
Hey!
So interesting.
How about that?
And so we get to this place where 1776 hit. Revolution starts, Declaration of Independence, all those things. And go take us back to where Lafayette is. And he hears word of this revolution that's happening. He wants to take part. But the folks around him are like, no, 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 no. You should not be participating in this. Let people of lower class go out there and die first. You stay here with us. And he decides he's not going to listen, and he sets out on a plan to go to the Americas. Tell us about that time, Chuck. Tell us about that and why, you know, and what he had to do in order to get there and take part.
Well, it was a stressful time for Lafayette. He was recently married. He had a child, and his wife was pregnant again. And he definitely wanted to make that trip. He wanted to be in the United States. And so what he decided to do was defy two of the most important people in France. One of those was the king, Louis XVI, and the other one was his father-in-law, who was a very, very powerful man. And he defied both of them and decided he was going to leave. He confided in his wife, Adrienne, by the way, an amazing woman, amazing woman. So he confided in her that he was going to do this, and he knew he had to leave France pretty much incognito. So he ended up, in order to do that, he had to buy a ship. He couldn't go on a ship because he had to put his name on the ship. He had to buy a ship. So he bought himself a ship. And legend
has
it.
He's a teenager, y'all. He's a teenager. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, and legend has it that in order to get to the ship, he had to disguise himself. And he disguised himself to get to the ship, boarded the ship with himself and several other men that wanted to be with him on this trip. And he made a very difficult crossing. It was a very difficult crossing, a three-month crossing across the Atlantic Ocean.
That was Chuck Schwamm, executive director of the American Friends of Lafayette. He joined us alongside Graham Brent, a member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee. Both joined us at our recent event at Brittingham's Pub in Lafayette Hill as we talked about the French influence on the American Revolution. In just a moment, we'll be back with more, including how the Marquis de Lafayette became a surrogate son to George Washington.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today's show is from a live event we hosted at Brittingham's Pub in Lafayette Hill as part of our series leading up to the 250th anniversary of American independence.
We're talking about the French influence on the American Revolution with Chuck Schwamm, executive director of the American Friends of Lafayette, and Graham Brent, a member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee. Let's get back to our conversation as we learn about what happened when the Marquis de Lafayette decided to cross the ocean to join George Washington's army.
The first Americans he saw were enslaved people. Oyster farmers in South Carolina. I think that's an important point.
It is.
Because Lafayette became an abolitionist. He became a friend of the enslaved.
He did.
Then he ended up going up to Philadelphia. It was a horrible trip up to Philadelphia from South Carolina.
It often is.
And I-95 wasn't there.
No, I-95.
But so in their diaries, a lot of the soldiers with Lafayette were saying how the food was terrible. The mosquitoes were big as birds.
Ooh.
The women were ugly.
Oh.
In Lafayette's diary, the place is beautiful. The food is delicious. The women are gorgeous. So
wow.
I just thought that was interesting to see through Lafayette's eyes on that trip up to Philadelphia. When he arrived, he knocked on the door of Independence Hall, and they told him to go away. But luckily, they did receive a letter later that evening from Benjamin Franklin saying that there would be a gentleman, the Marquis de Lafayette, arriving, and he's pretty much the richest man in France. You probably should accept him.
Maybe open that
maybe
door.
For some donations. Yeah. Maybe so for some donations.
He got a knock on his hotel room door, and before you know it, he was a general in our Continental Army.
Yeah, but when they made him a general initially, and I think you kind of hinted at this, Graham, they didn't give him actual people to command. They gave him the title, but they were like, nah, we're not going to give you people.
Sort of more of a General Mills type general,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. That was one of the things that he misunderstood. Maybe it was a communication issue. Maybe it was a language problem. But yeah, he fully understood that he thought that as a major general, he would be in command, and that was not the original plan. That did happen eventually, but he actually had to prove himself on the battlefield, which he did within very short order, in fact.
Yeah, and so how does that happen, Chuck? How does he earn the trust and the respect of folks like Washington so he starts to, you know, rise?
Two things happen. Well, he meets Washington at City Tavern in Philadelphia on July 31st, and we'll be recreating that in 2027 as well. Probably one of the most important days of my life, because that relationship is what sparked my interest in Lafayette.
Yes. Washington and Lafayette.
Right. The next day, Lafayette goes to review the troops, and George Washington turns to Lafayette and he says, "What do you think?" And Lafayette looks at George Washington and says, "General, I'm here to learn, not to teach." And I thought that was a moment where Washington said, "Hey, this guy's different than the other people they're sending over. This guy wants to learn." Well, then fast forward to September 11th. at Brandywine, the Battle of Brandywine. And the Battle of Brandywine is going poorly, and Lafayette and George Washington are overlooking the battle. And Lafayette sees that things aren't going well, and the retreat is going really poorly. And Lafayette just really wants to get in there. And finally, George reluctantly says, okay, go. And he gallops down there, and he helps organize a very important retreat, saves hundreds of men's lives. And this is, think about it, he just turned 20 5 days earlier, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, then while he's doing this, baptism by blood, he gets shot in the leg. And he gets up wounded, but he gets up, realizes his boot is filling with blood, but he continues with the retreat, and again, saves hundreds of American lives that day at Brandywine.
Yeah.
And that is a very impressive thing for General Washington to see.
And then the very next year, he served with distinction in the Battle of Rhode Island as well. So he really started to prove himself as a formidable person on the battlefield. I want to follow up with you, Chuck, about the relationship between George Washington and Lafayette, because I saw Hamilton a couple times. and I mean, he was friends with, you know, Alexander Hamilton. He was also really good friends with George Washington. Can you talk about those relationships, how they developed, and what made them different?
In a lot of ways, Hamilton was correct. I mean, Hamilton, Lafayette, John Lawrence, very important man. Everybody should read about John Lawrence, died in 1783. These guys hung out. They risked their lives together. They were working together. It was an amazing trio. But the relationship between George Washington is what is most special. And a lot of people look at it as a paternal relationship. Think about George Washington never had children. Lafayette became an orphan at 11. His father died when he was 2. Lafayette was in his early 20s. George Washington was in his mid-40s. It was a perfect storm for them as well. And this relationship, I think, was more than paternal. But what I found interesting about this relationship is George Washington kind of had a force field around him. Nobody touched him. He rarely smiled. He didn't show emotion, except when Lafayette was in the room, except when he wrote to Lafayette. In diaries of some of the soldiers, they said that Lafayette and Washington hugged. They never saw anybody even touch George Washington before. This relationship was special, and it's what sparked a lot of our interest.
Wow.
So it's 1778, I believe, France formally recognizes American independence, which is certainly important symbolically, but France is not like involved the way they will be in the conflict yet. And then Lafayette goes back to France. First of all, I think he's placed under house arrest when he gets there. So first of all, Grant explained that, but then once he gets out of house arrest, what role does he play, if any, in trying to, you know, get the French a little bit more pot committed?
So you remember what Chuck said about him leaving France without the permission, in fact, actually directly against the permission of the king. So when he comes back, but in the intervening time, stories about Lafayette have been crossing the Atlantic, and he's become a hero. I mean, everyone's talking about him, even at Versailles. Everyone's just, I mean, he is the national hero. And in fact, that's where the expression hero of two worlds eventually comes, the héros de deux mondes, because he ends up being a hero in both countries. So when he gets back, the king is well disposed, but he has to at least fulfill some kind of obligation to punish him. So he goes under house arrest for a nominal amount of time. And then, of course, he's received back at Versailles. But it is important to note that how did this support actually start with the French? Because it was clandestine long before it was made public, right? Long before the Treaty of Amity and Commerce and the Treaty of Alliances were signed in February 1778, when, by the way, everyone was at Valley Forge, which is also famously where Lafayette, when he heard the news, when the news actually arrived, it took till May for the news to arrive at Valley Forge that the alliance had been signed with the French. And at that news, Lafayette famously jumped into George Washington's arms and said, you know, he kissed him on the cheek, I believe. So, which was absolutely. And he would be the only person that could get away with it. But before that, our friend de Bonvouloir, who had met with Ben Franklin, John Jay, and Francis Damon, and Ben Franklin in Carpenter's Hall, as a result of that, he had gone back and provided a glowing report to Louis XVI, how the soldiers here were all well-armed, they were going to win, everyone was behind them. And so this is the chance that you need to take now, because if you don't, they may fail. And we want to get in behind there and have the success that, and humiliate England back. So That was all happening covertly because obviously at that time, France did not want to enter into war with Britain. It wasn't ready. It was its fleet and its armies were decimated after the French and Indian Wars.
But I'm just trying to imagine from the perspective of the French, as they're debating what to do here and how involved to get, they have to be thinking, A, we're in debt. B, the British kind of just kicked our butts. Not
pretty
great
bad.
Precedent.
Yeah.
And we're also supporting a sort of counter-nobility, counter-monarchical cause here, which might not be awesome precedent to set.
Later on.
Our own country, our many colonies around the world, like there's so many things I could think that would keep them from making this commitment. Chuck, why do you think the French weren't hung up on those things to the point they stayed out?
They were waiting to see if we got a win, and we did get a win, and we had a big win in Saratoga. And so that was what they wanted to see if we could handle it ourselves first. They were hedging their bets, so to speak. They hated the British. They had the axe to grind. They also wanted to trade with us. They wanted to be able to trade with the United States. Our natural resources were second to none at that time. So with that being said, they were waiting for the win, and we had a big win. We captured Burgoyne's army. It was unforeseen. It was something that nobody ever thought would happen, and it happened. And when they saw that we could do that, they jumped in with both feet.
And so what did French support look like? I'm thinking for folks who may not know, like what did that look like once they signed these treaties, once they were fully on board and they decided to go with these patriots that fighting against Britain? What did you think?
Well, it's worth pointing out, jumping on what Chuck just said, is that the rifles, almost all the rifles used at Saratoga were French. Mm-hmm. So it is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? That they were providing covert assistance, which actually in the end they would reap the rewards. And when you look at the French involvement overall, something like 90% of all the black powder used was French. There were more French troops at the Battle of Yorktown than there were American troops.
Yeah. But let's get into the interim there. So this is still a period of persuasion. Yes, the French are behind the revolution. Yes, they acknowledge independence, all important things, but there's still more that they can do and will do. So how do the colonists and Lafayette convince the French to do even more toward the cause of American independence?
Well, I think it was Lafayette and Ben Franklin
did
that. And what we wanted were ships.
They're the lobbyists.
Right, they're the lobbyists. And we wanted ships and we wanted men because we were, like he said, we were already getting the guns or the cannons, all that stuff. Yep. But we did not have a navy. Think about it. We had no navy. So the British were just doing whatever they want on the Eastern Seaboard. So we needed ships. We needed people. And that's what they convinced them to do. And they did it in July of 1780. Rochambeau arrived in Newport with thousands of French people, French soldiers.
And tell us a little bit about Lafayette's personality, because he was very charismatic. People really liked him on both sides of the pond. Could you just talk about him a little bit and how he was able to be so convincing?
So... He was a great PR guy. There's no doubt about it. He really was. There was some naivety about Lafayette as well that I think attracted people to him. I mean, he was young and everything and all that, but he was relentless. He wrote letter after letter. He got up into people's grill like nobody else could. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And he just wouldn't stop. I think that was his secret weapon, is that he was just relentless. He believed in our cause so deeply that he wrote letters into the way into the morning every night, just trying to convince people. And not only letters into France, but also have letters to our Congress, to other generals. So he was very involved in that way. So I would say Lafayette's superpower was that he was relentless.
Yeah, very passionate.
And of course, he's there at a really pivotal moment that helps close the war, Yorktown. So let's set the scene of Yorktown, Grant. For folks who haven't seen Ken Burns' American Revolution series yet, remind us what happens at Yorktown and what the French and Lafayette's involvement is in that pivotal showdown.
Well, so you have to remember, Lafayette has been back to France. The initial overt response from France was a bit of a misfire. A general by the name of the Comte d'Estaing came over with a fleet. It didn't go well, just a short story. There were issues with weather. There were communication issues between D'Estaing and his continental counterparts. He actually then went off to the West Indies, came back, tried to retrieve Charleston, didn't work, and he went home. So that was one of the reasons why Lafayette went back over to France to say, hey, we got to do this better. We've got to have more of this. And King Louis agreed. So now he's back. He comes back over. He actually wanted to lead the expeditionary force. He was, I think, Rochambeau, who actually did lead it, had actually more years experience than Lafayette had been alive. Yeah. So he was up to the obvious choice, but it is testimony to Lafayette's enthusiasm that he felt he might be the one. So he's back over. And then the question is, what happens now with this unified force between Rochambeau, who, by the way, even though he was leading all the French troops, agreed to report to Washington. Yeah. So Washington was actually in charge with Rochambeau's agreement. Washington really wanted to assault New York. He felt like New York was the place to go. Rochambeau did not agree, and they ended up, all the troops moved down south to where the war was really taking place. And Lafayette had been sent there by Washington, much to his chagrin initially, because
he's like, why am I going into this backwater?
Exactly. Yeah. Because everyone felt, just like when the British moved into Philadelphia earlier, they felt like, okay, we got them now, we got the capital. Well, what happened? The capital just moved to York, right?
Yeah, right.
So then when the Treaty of Amity and Commerce was signed, they realized they had to get out. They had to leave that Philadelphia, and that's why they went. But anyway, so Lafayette is now in the South, and his job was to harass the enemy. He was outnumbered, but that's what he did. And he noticed that he could corner. He wrote back to Washington, and he said, I can corner Cornwallis. I believe I can corner him. And that's what the orders he was given to do so at Yorktown. It was a mistake, actually, a military mistake for Cornwallis to move to Yorktown, to camp there.
Yeah, and you need to know the geography a little bit, but basically, Yorktown is pretty easy to cut off from the rest of Virginia. It's situated near where the Chesapeake Bay opens up into the ocean. So the Chesapeake Bay is really big and strategically important, but it's a very narrow opening getting into the bay. So that's sort of why the British are there, right? But that's also just that land is easy to isolate. And then that sets up the big moment here.
Well, the bigger moment, frankly, probably was the fact that the French ships and the British ships had a battle right outside of Yorktown to gain that access point. Yeah. And thankfully, the French won that. That was Admiral de Grasse. And so we then had them cornered. Lafayette cornered them on land. De Grasse cornered them in on the sea. And that's when they wrote a letter up to Washington saying, I think we got a good situation here. Come on down. And they came down, and it wasn't a battle. It was a siege. And Rochambeau was an expert at siege warfare. And basically what that is they dug a trench and they put their artillery in there and they started firing it at the British. And then at night they dig a trench closer and closer. Before long, they're just lobbing cannonballs right into the fort. And at that point, there were two readouts that were left. Do you want to talk about the readouts?
Sure. Let's talk about the readouts.
The readouts are important because the readouts were two last places where the British were holding on. And George Washington gave the honor of one redoubt to Alexander Hamilton. And this is important because it's Hamilton's first command. And he was really excited. And he gave the other command to Lafayette, but Lafayette didn't actually go to the redoubt. He commanded it from afar. The Americans and the French both took all their musket balls out of their guns, out of their other muskets, took their flints away, and went in with bayonets only in the middle of the night. Think about that. It took the Americans about 10 minutes to take the redoubt. It was a bloody situation, but they took it about 10 minutes, and they sent a courier over to the other redoubt to see if the French had taken theirs yet, and they hadn't. So the Americans, they took redoubt 9, I think, and the Americans took redoubt 10 a few minutes later. Wow. And the rest is history. A few days later, the British surrendered.
Wow. And what did this victory with the French and the Americans sort of working together, what did this do to their relationship? I mean, they're like blood brothers at this point.
Well, I want to just say, Graham said something. I want to make sure everybody heard this. There were more French military personnel at Yorktown than American. That's an important thing. Think about that for a second, folks. I mean, I know fish and chips is on the menu, but it would be our national food if it wasn't for the French. Okay?
They are drinking Guinness, you know.
So I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure.
No, it goes to the point that like the French military support was not. And sometimes you can get the impression living here that it's this little flurry that came in at the end that was maybe a cherry on top. No, it's like essential to these pivotal moments that ultimately, I think, convince the British like this is a lost cause. Let them go. Is that a fair description,
Graham? Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've hit the main points, right? So Saratoga was a big deal. And we talk about Boston and Bunker Hill. But that was more a situation where the British, again, it was not unlike Yorktown in a way, because the British realized that they couldn't really hold on there and they moved out. So the Americans did hold the field. But after that, it was just a succession of defeats. I mean, Washington made several mistakes militarily, and it was a cascade of mistakes all the way down. And it wasn't until he crossed the Delaware, as famously did so on Christmas Eve, that really, I think, the French started to take it seriously.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like we said, there was a self-fulfilling prophecy at Saratoga. But there were a lot of defeats along the way. Indeed, more defeats than wins, indeed. So Yorktown wasn't the last battle of the war. It was the last major battle.
Yep.
And it really set up the stage for Ben Franklin in Paris to start negotiating a peace treaty.
Wow. And so it feels like this is something I think a lot of Americans don't realize, how pivotal the French were to the revolution being a success. Why do you think that is?
They're not teaching it in our schools.
I mean,
that's the bottom line. I mean, our organization, one of the things we're trying to do is make sure people understand that, we helped the French in World War I, and we helped the French in World War II, but if it wasn't for the French, we would not have won the Revolutionary War. And this is not being taught in the schools. We did change the curriculum in the state of Virginia, so they're now teaching it there. We're going one state at a time, and hopefully by the end of my lifetime, everybody will be learning about the French's involvement.
Well, and another way of putting that is that the irony is if the French hadn't helped us in the first place, we wouldn't have been in a position to help them in World War I or World War II.
That was Graham Brent, a member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee. He joined us recently at Brittingham's Pub in Lafayette Hill alongside Chuck Schwamm, executive director of the American Friends of Lafayette.
In just a moment, we'll learn what happens to Lafayette after he helps American revolutionaries buck the British monarchy and how his story is often forgotten by modern Americans. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're bringing you a live event we hosted at Brittingham's Pub in Lafayette Hill as part of our series leading up to the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution.
We sat down with Chuck Schwamm, executive director of the American Friends of Lafayette, and Graham Brent, a member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee.
We've been talking about the French role in the American Revolution, and in particular, about one of George Washington's closest confidants, Marquis de Lafayette. Let's pick up the conversation here as Lafayette returns home to France, a powerful European monarchy not too dissimilar from the one he just helped to rebuke.
It's a little ironic, if you don't know the full story, why a king who's ruling by divine right, Louis XVI, should be funding a revolution against the monarchy.
Yeah.
But we know the background to that and why that was. It was a pursuit of revenge. So they got their revenge, but then just like after the Seven Years' War, they were broke, even more broke than when they started. I mean, they contributed more finances. They were really broke. America managed to pay its debts off eventually over a fairly short period. France did not. They got deeper and deeper into debt.
So the French are pretty stretched thin because of this particular conflict.
Yeah. Exactly. And it got worse and worse. I mean, it was a national movement. And it was unfortunate, too, because climatically there were problems. There were bad harvests. Bread was the main food at that time. And flour became very scarce. Things got worse and worse. And then, of course, it ended up with the famous storming of the Bastille in 1789. And for the next year, things were okay. We talk about, the terror and so forth and all the guillotines and that. But for that first year, things settled down, and Lafayette was still the hero. He was made a Marechal of France, which is the highest honor that Louis XVI could give him. They formed the National Guard, and he became head of the National Guard of Paris, which pretty much meant he was running the country.
Yeah. I was trying to understand sort of his position vis-a-vis the revolution in France, and it seems like he is, on one hand, still inspired by these ideals of self-rule and a lot of the things that got him into the American Revolution. He's not quite as radical, though, as maybe like your Robespierre and your more extreme elements. Where is he sort of on the spectrum
when you talk about the sort of the political class that's involved in the revolution in France? Lafayette was on his own spectrum because Lafayette did something that nobody else was really trying to do, and that was trying to keep both sides happy.
Yeah.
In other words, Lafayette was siding with the people, but he also believed in the monarchy.
Yeah.
So he wanted
Didn't he have a daughter named Marie Antoinette?
He had a daughter named Virginie.
Okay. Yeah.
Named at Virginia, and he had a son named, can anybody guess? George Washington Lafayette.
George Washington. They loved George Washington.
So
he was trying to keep both sides happy.
His political viewpoint, sort of vis-a-vis everyone else who's involved in this major change.
So he was friends with the king. He went to school with the king. I mean, it was his king. It was divine. So he thought about that, but he also saw what was going on in America and the rights of the people, and they were able to govern themselves. So he wanted a constitutional monarchy. So when you're trying to keep everybody happy, what happens?
You make everybody mad.
That's right. And that eventually happened, and Lafayette had to leave France. He had to escape.
Wow. And so what happened to him after that? When the revolution's going on, everything's changing in France, what happens to him?
So he left France under advisement of many people. And he got caught in Austria because the Austrian king said, hey, if you're not a friend of monarchs, you're not a friend of mine. And more or less, he was thrown in jail there in Austria. He moved around a little bit, but he ended up in a little town called Olmütz, which is now in the Czech Republic. And he served 5 years in jail in Olmütz in a horrible, it wasn't a country called prison. It was horrible conditions. And I'm going to add to the story real quick. His wife and two daughters joined him in prison after a couple of years.
Explain that part of it.
I can't explain that. Think about that for a second. These were terrible conditions. And by the way, his wife, Adrienne, eventually got so sick, she eventually died from being in that prison, not in the prison, but later on. But she wanted to free him. She tried to free him. She talked to the Austrian king, please free my husband, blah, blah. He said no. She said, then I want to be with him. And he granted that. And the two daughters and the wife ended up being there for like 2 years.
As we get ready to wrap up, we have to mention one other major figure that Lafayette has a relation to, which is Napoleon. Okay, so it's interesting, right? Because we're trying to paint this picture of this guy. He definitely has these high-minded ideals. He is into some form of rule by the people, but still married in some ways to the idea of monarchy. Napoleon's kind of a vexing figure for someone in that particular position. Explain real quickly, Graham, his relationship to Napoleon, and from what I understand, his sort of refusal to kiss the ring, ultimately, when it comes to Napoleon.
Yeah, you could say that his relationship with Napoleon was complicated.
Yeah.
They were both military commanders, so they respected each other militarily, there's no question. And Napoleon was pivotal in releasing Lafayette from prison.
Gets him free.
Yeah. He does, absolutely. Yeah, as part of the settlement with Austria. So I think at the back of his mind, there was always a certain amount of gratitude for that. And I think he was prepared to give Napoleon an opportunity, give him a shot to see exactly how this was going to shake out. And of course, to cut a long story short, over time, he realized that, no, this guy is headed for
really a despot.
He's really no different. Well, he's actually worse than a divine right king because he is a despot. And so they disagreed. Napoleon was furious most of the time with Lafayette. They made a couple of attempts to reconcile, but it didn't work out.
Wow.
But it just goes to show he really held fast to his ideals through a lot of change. And it must have been tempting to be like, Napoleon's the game in town. Let me see if I can make this work. But ultimately, he concluded, Napoleon is just tyrannical.
He made himself emperor. That did not sit well with Lafayette at all.
Yeah.
And so Lafayette, you talked about, he was relentless. He lived to be in his 70s, didn't pass away till 1834. Talk about this relentlessness and the things that he did later in life and how, you know, the people in two countries, America and in France, still just really loved this man.
Well, he helped with revolutions all around the world. He helped with the revolution in Bolivia. He helped the revolution in Greece. He helped with revolutions all over the place. In fact, him and Bolivar became very close friends. So that was part of his life later in life. But probably the most important thing he did was he came back to the United States. And as a 60-some-year-old man, he traveled around our country for 13 months. He visited all 24 states in our union. We estimate he went 6,000 miles and saw about 4 million people. So that's a lot for an older man. And many times he showed up in the middle of the night, at 2 a.m, riding in a carriage, trying to sleep in a carriage. And this is a man that wanted to see the people. The people wanted to see him. And I think that shows the character of Lafayette.
Wow.
I want to say, Chuck and Graham, thank you so much
for your insights. We want to open it up to questions now, but first, a round of applause.
Yes.
For our lovely guests.
Who's got a question?
I'm Kate Hanley, and I'm from Glenside. So after Napoleon, we've got the restitution of the monarchy, and then we have a few other things that happen in France. Before he passes away in 34, how did Lafayette feel about these changes in government?
Oof. It's a complicated one, yeah.
Well, definitely a grand question.
Well, it's really not. I'm not an expert necessarily on that part of his life, but suffice to say he was in and out of the legislature, and his political flame ebbed and flowed, if you will. He was able to represent sections of the country in the Chamber of Deputies, and he did what he could to promote his ideals. But as we've already said, as Chuck said, it was a constant battle because he was always in the center of everything, so he was never pleasing either side. He wasn't radical enough for the right or the left.
Chuck and Graham, thank you both so much for your time today. It was really wonderful. Thanks to all of you for being here.
We appreciate that. I know, Chuck, I know you wanted to say that you guys have some big things coming up in 2027. I want to give you a moment to plug your big event.
So the American Friends of Lafayette were born in 1932. We have 1,500 members around the country, a few in France. We were born at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. So that's where we were born.
No, I'm just saying, yeah.
And so in 2024, 2025, we followed Lafayette around the country exactly as it happened 200 years earlier. So if he was in St. Louis on March 4th, we were holding an event in St. Louis on March 4th. If he was in Mobile, Alabama, we were in wherever he went exactly in chronological order, we did that. And it was amazing. People came out in droves, not 4 million people, but maybe 400,000 people. We really did have a lot of people. In 2027, we're going to do the same thing with a young Lafayette. He steps on American soil on June 13th, 1777. So we'll be in South Carolina on June 13th, 2027, and we'll follow him up the East Coast. We'll knock on Independence Hall door. We'll have him meet George Washington at City Tavern. I'm going to try to shoot our interpreter in the leg at Brandywine. I don't know how that's going to go. But he's a wonderful 19-year-old man. He'll take it like a kid. I'm sure he'll be fine. And we're going to do this all the way through 2031 till Yorktown. And it's going to be really special. And this is our way of educating the public. If you want to learn more, friendsoflafayette.org.
All right.
All right.
That was Chuck Schwamm, Executive Director of the American Friends of Lafayette. You also heard Graham Brent, a member of the Philadelphia Lafayette Bicentennial Committee. Both joined us at our recent event at Brittingham's Pub in Lafayette Hill as we talked about the French influence on the American Revolution.
Last but not least, we're closing out the show today with a little bit of music. This is a song from an a cappella group called the Colonial Revelers.
God save our 13 states. Long live United States, God save our states. Make us victorious, happy and glorious. No tyrants over us, God save our states. We'll fear no tyrants not, nor stern oppression's rod. Till time's no more. May union bless our land, while we with heart and hand our mutual rights defend on our free shore. God save our 13 states, long live United States, God save our states. Make us victorious, happy and glorious. No tyrants over us, God save our states.
That was the a cappella group Colonial Revelers singing God Save Our 13 States. Thanks to the staff at Brittingham's, and thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks as well to our engineers, Al Banks and Adam Sanishevsky. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Tomorrow at noon, we're back live with a roundtable of the most pressing national, state, and local political stories. We're going rapid fire with two of our favorite political commentators.
Is there something you think has been going under the radar? Plan to join in and we'll have them react. Until then, catch up on Studio 2 on your favorite podcast app and on WHYY's YouTube channel. Coming up next, it's Here and Now.